three handouts over here. Periodization, South Vietnam historical map, and the 1968 Tet Offensive map. All right, this is November the 3rd, and this is lecture 19, the middle and final years of the Vietnam War. We're running a bit behind, so lecture 20, the Paris peace talks, will have to be pushed back a week. It will come on November 10th. That's for you who still have the handout at the start of the year with our class schedule. Now, this is the middle and final years of the Vietnam War. The war, really, the Vietnam War can be considered as having been two wars back to back. First half, was a revolutionary guerrilla war, 1959 to 1965, as you see in the periodization chart. Second half was from then to the end, April 30th, 1975. Second half of the war was more or less small-scale Korea-type war. It's the middle and the final years. For the high command in Hanoi, for the Paban generals, this second half, beginning in 1965, meant entering the war in a more direct manner than before. Also meant a new strategy. The American army was coming in force, and how to deal with this. The conversion, you can call it that, began in late 1954 and took about a year to complete. It was what came to be called regular force strategy. This is in North Vietnam terminology. Objective was still the same, unification. Now it meant a toe-to-toe military slugging match by the southern PLAF and the northern Paban, with Paban increasingly and reluctantly assuming a larger share in the burden of combat against ARVA, increasingly aided by the U.S. and other allied forces. Armed struggle now took a doctrinal command. The dice of battle became the determinant. Paban troops and Paban generals began taking over in the south, pushing the southern VC into the background and proclaiming as the only goal unification of the fatherland. Many old-line southern party cadres defected during this period, giving as their reason, I talked to many of them, betrayal of the revolution. The Politburo's assessment in January 1965 was that the war was about over. It would probably be only a matter of weeks, but certainly by the end of the year, 1965. Now, that view was shared by many in Saigon, in Mac V, and in the embassy. In fact, it remains something of a mystery why the communists did not win the Vietnam War in the spring of 1965. Nothing done either by Arvin or U.S. combat troops in the first months altered the hard strategic situation. Logically, the South Vietnam VC Army, the PLA, Liberation Army as they called it, should have destroyed the last Arvin reserve battalions, then moved on to take the major cities. Nature of the war was such that the South Vietnamese units had to defend a large number of fixed installations. And the enemy, the VC, could then concentrate and hit one of these installations, which meant that Arvin had to call the reserve battalions up to reinforce this position under attack. And the VC strategy was to destroy these reserve battalions one after another. And by February of 65, they had just about destroyed all of them. And once your reserve battalions are gone, it means that the enemy hits one place, they hit Tan Son Nhut Airport, and you move. Now, you don't have any reserves, so you bring troops from Kanto up to reinforce this. This leaves Kanto wide open, and they can take it out, and they can just pick you out one by one. And that was the prospect, and it was what, of course, forced the Americans to come to the hard decision. Either we're going to get into this right now in a big way, or we're going to cut our losses. And that decision was really made in February of 1965. The American airstrikes began at once in February of 65, but these had actually little effect on communist control of the villages. American troops arrived in numbers only at the end of the summer. We were not actually in a position of strength until the end of the year, 1965. What prevented communist victory was the psychological impact in both North and South Vietnam, among North Vietnamese and South Vietnamese of all stripes, that the Americans were entering the war. Hanoi's perception particularly was that they were about to be massively assaulted by the richest, the most powerful nation on earth, which had never lost a war. Understandably, there was a great deal of anxiety over this, especially in Hanoi, and a great deal of expectation among the South Vietnamese. In fact, however, this measure of U.S. military prowess within Vietnam was exaggerated. The chief U.S. problem was to translate its admittedly immense military strength, much of which was nuclear, into something that was meaningful for the kind of war that was being fought in Vietnam. The Politburo and General Giap were convinced that a new strategy was required to meet this new threat, regardless of how well the present threat or strategy of chopping up the reserve battalions was working. Hence, instead of making an all-out armed and political struggle attack before the Americans arrived and got set, which they could have done in the summer of 65, they ordered an interim retrenchment to buy time to develop a new doctrine. It was a major error on the part of the North Vietnamese. The basic change of Hanoi's strategy, however, was not simply a response to American entry. It had, in fact, been underway since at least the summer of 1964. The genesis of the change from revolutionary guerrilla war to regular force strategy was in part the result of Politburo infighting, particularly the acute and long-abiding dispute between General Giap and Lê Duẩn and the other big war strategists, big unit war strategists, against Trung Chinh and his protracted conflict, guerrilla philosophy of military organization. Strong doubt was growing among the Politburo members, whether among all of them, I think, as to whether actual victory could be delivered by the revolutionary war strategy that had been practiced in the South since the beginning. That it could create social pathology, there was no doubt. But social disintegration in the South is not necessarily the same as unification. Hence, the belief grew that the more orthodox forces were required to deliver this final blow, this coup de grace. There was also a growing Politburo suspicion about the reliability of the apparatus in the South, that is, the Viet Cong National Liberation Front. The Politburo felt uncomfortable with a system that granted so much autonomy to these unreliable Southerners. Yet revolutionary guerrilla war requires that you give a great deal of local authority to the commander. You can't run a guerrilla war from the capital. It has to be local decisions locally made. That means they have a great deal of autonomy and have an independent attitude toward not only the war, but the purposes of the war. So when the end came, and it was seen as coming soon, Hanoi meant to have on the scene a completely loyal military force to ensure that the war was not won and the peace lost through some last-minute settlement that would have the net effect, as in 1954 in the Viet Minh War, of betraying the cause of unification. The decision to send Pavan forces in number south, it was clear to us later, was made at a party plenum in February 1964, almost a year before the Americans decided to come in. Special 6 week training sessions for this assignment at the famed Swan Mai infiltration camp outside of Hanoi began in the spring, and the trainees entered the pipeline, the Ho Chi Minh Trail, in late summer. By the end of the year, they were arriving in strength. This was 2 months before the American decision to enter the war. It was, as I say, they needed these forces for a coup de grace, and they also wanted loyal troops on the ground when the end came. But didn't eventuate. And so for the next 3 years in the war was all military, all battlefield, all armed struggle, and the time really belonged to General Jopp. Warfare, as I've said, is mass and movement. Jopp's problem was how to match or nullify the advantages the Americans had in massive firepower and their mobility, which was provided by the ubiquitous helicopter. It's not a question of skill or brains or courage. These existed more or less equally on both sides, all sides. But it was a matter of technology that had revolutionized warfare in a single decade. What was Allied strategy in this time? What indeed? It was reactive, it was defensive, it was responding to whatever the enemy was doing. It was much irrelevant action. This is a very seductive thing that happens in warfare, to do what you can do, what you're capable of doing, rather than what needs to be done. Put artillery on a hill, whether you really need it up there, whether it really does anything except fire a lot of guns, shells, airstrikes from the sea. Both military and civilian governments have this problem of meeting a problem by doing something that they don't know what to do, so they do something. It's said, I'm told, that the unofficial slogan of Fort Bragg, which is an infantry school, is do something even if it's wrong. There was a sign outside the one of these hills when I was there, and I asked this captain who was standing around, said, what is that, black humor? And he said, no, that's very sound judgment. Do something even if it's wrong. The worst thing you can do is do nothing. You're pinned down and you're getting fire. Do something, anything. The worst thing you can do is to do nothing, just to sit there and to be destroyed. There was something, the same attitude, I think, in the State Department, too. There, the attitude is not do nothing, just postpone it for a day or a week. It's easy to see that in retrospect. It's not at all easy to see at the time what it is that you should do that's meaningful. The other side, of course, made the same mistake. They were always doing things that were absolutely irrelevant and material, and you wondered why they wasted time and money and lives on it. But by the standards that the Americans and the Allies had fixed for themselves, they seemed to be making progress. This was through 1966 and 67. Officials in both Washington and Saigon were suspicious of some of the claims, the body count, for example. But most of them, which was the heart of the American strategy, which was to destroy more enemy troops than they can resupply. But by July, it seemed that we had reached the crossover point at which more enemy soldiers were being killed and could be replaced. At the end of 1967, General Westmoreland said this to the press: "In many areas of the country, the enemy has been driven away from the population centers. Others, he has been compelled to disperse and avoid contact. The year has ended with the enemy resorting to desperation tactics to achieve military psychological victory. He has experienced only failure in these attempts." The Americans conducted search and destroy missions. Arvin provided local defense, both concentrated on pacification, and is turning the war over to the Vietnamese to permit American withdrawal. For some simplification, this was General Westmoreland's three-tier strategy. How is one to measure the success of this strategy at the time? In linear wars, measurement is easy, especially in terms of geographic objectivity. In World War II, for example, an objective after securing the beachhead at Normandy was the Seine River. And if at D-Day plus 90 you were there, you were on time. If not, you had a problem. But how do you measure progress when the objective is destruction of 40% of the enemy base area? How does the command know if the strategy is working? Well, the answer was a series of indicators developed by McVie in Saigon, but more the case by Robert McNamara, Secretary of Defense back in the Pentagon, about whom much more later lecture. Now, these indicators went by several successive names: MPS, Measurement of Progress System; HES, H-E-S, Hamlet Evaluation System. At one point, we had 105 indicators of how the war was going. This was McNamara's belief that anything you could measure, anything you could stuff into a computer, could be what's all you needed to look at in terms of when nothing else mattered. So some of these indicators were weapons recovery ratio. How many weapons did you take back from the enemy each day? A number of hamlet chiefs who slept in their own hamlet at night rather than driving to the district capital and sleeping there. A control of certain road stretches. ABC rating as to how safe this road was. Now, all the roads in the country, but divided into units. And the famous body count, which we didn't have in other wars, and which was sort of foisted on the press by the briefers at what was called the 5 o'clock follies, 5 o'clock briefing at the embassy every day. Old line reporters, those had been in World War II and in Korea, you know, would say, "I don't know why you people are pushing this body count. We didn't have this in the war, in the other wars, and we're not really sure it's all that important. But you're making so much of it that any time Kai's Beach, the Chicago Daily News, saying every time I leave it out, I get a racket from Chicago saying, 'What was the body count today?'" And then there was all sorts of questions about the validity of the body count and what bodies are you counting, and guesses by people after action that, well, we think about 15 were killed, although they took the bodies away, so we don't know. So the whole thing was suspect, and it was, I would argue, basically meaningless anyway. But these were the indicators, as I say, 105 in all. And by these indicators, we were winning. And McNamara would come out and say, "I don't see what's wrong with these journalists. Don't they know? Don't they see these indicators? Can't they see that we're winning the war?" And by these indicators, I would say we were winning the war. One of the ironies of the Vietnam War. And things were going well for the Americans on the battlefield. You know, we never lost a single battle, significant battle. Which brings us to TET, 1968, Lunar New Year 1968, Chinese New Year 1968. You've never heard anything about Vietnam War. You've probably heard about Tet 68. So, then the run-up to it. Americans had landed in strength, and General Giap came up with a plan, which he, I think I have a note here, which he, yeah, he spelled it out in a book called Great Victory, Big Task, which was written and published before, it had to do with the 1967-68 Winter Spring Offensive. And this laid out how it was going to be fought, as far as he was concerned. We didn't read it until later. After the, I did. I wrote several pieces about it. I got quoted on CBS. Eric Severide made a special broadcast on it. But it didn't seem to have any effect. To this day, I don't know whether American command, I don't know whether, McNamara, for example, read this book or not. Anyway, Jacques spelled this out, what he was going to do, very clearly. He said, we're going to have this 1967-68 winter-spring campaign. It's going to be 9 months long, going to be divided into three phases of 3 months each. Phase one, and he did unroll about as he said they would. Phase one was October, November, and December of 1967. It was a series of what was called, what did he call them? Coordinated fighting methods. Jop used all this obscure terminology. That was what made reading them hard. Tried to figure out what he meant by this, but there were two kinds of fighting, coordinated and independent. So in this first phase, it was going to be nothing but coordinated fighting methods, that is, attacks against a series of mid-sized battles on the chain of mountain positions all up and down South Vietnam, Cong Tin, Lac Ninh, and Khe San, the famous Khe San. They were along the border, most of them, and they were in the mountains. And Jop's intention, and he didn't say this, but it was clear that it was to focus American attention and interest and resources away from his other objectives, the general offensive. These 3 months were extremely expensive in terms of manpower, which Jop simply dismissed. At the end of that in December, he said, the life and death of 100 or 1,000 or tens of thousands of human beings, even if they are our own compatriots, represent very little. In terms of goals and losses, they are irrelevant. Now, phase one, I guess, would be considered a kind of toss-up. Jop did not win these battles, but he didn't lose them either. And if his purpose was to tie Americans down, it succeeded. Phase two of the offensive was January, February, and March. Whereas phase one had used what he called coordinated fighting methods, phase two was independent fighting methods. Many simultaneous attacks launched at a time when the enemy least expects them, New Year's Day. So it began January 30th, 1968, at the dark of the moon. North Vietnamese and Viet Cong forces attacked 36 of the 44 provincial capitals. Five out of six of the autonomous cities, and the capital, Saigon. 64 of the 240 district capitals, and 50 hamlets, which happened to be in key positions. The outcome of this, not to keep you in suspense, all of these attacks were turned back. But the result was that the PLF forces, the South Vietnamese, were very badly decimated. In fact, they never recovered. I knew Viet Cong afterwards, who said this was deliberate by Hanoi. They deliberately threw us into this to destroy us, because they didn't want us to be in strength at the end of the year when the war was over and the Northerners had won. There's no proof whatsoever on this, but I don't know what the proof would be if you couldn't. The point is that many of these so-called battles had no military significance, and they weren't even intended to. It was a squad, a VC squad, that went over the wall at the U.S. Embassy, and they never made it to the front door. They were cut down by Marines with machine guns in the rough. But 29, you couldn't have expected them to. I mean, it wasn't reasonable to expect that they would be able to take the embassy, and I don't think that was the intention. There were three sappers, as far as I could tell, who hit the palace, presidential palace. It was a big building in the middle of a big yard with a very big, tall iron fence around it. And I happened to talk later to one of these three sappers who was in this attack. He was 15 years old. His two friends, he said, he thought 14 or 15. They were in a house across the street from the palace, a British embassy house, with a couple of cadres, and they were looking out the window at this iron fence, and the cadre gave this first kid a satchel charge and say, run across the street, put it up against that fence and pull this cord. So out the door he went. He got almost to the fence when the machine guns on the roof cut him down. Then he turned to the second kid and said, okay, now you do it. You get out there. So he got almost to the street, out the door and about to the street, and he was cut down. And so, and this is the third kid I talked to. He turned to the third kid who was out the back door and down the street and out of the war. And, I said, why did these other two do it? Well, we really believed in this. We thought we could do it. We thought we'd live forever. But the point is, this was not a serious military attack. It made the newsreels, of course, that the sappers had attacked the embassy or the palace. I think they used a couple of hundred against 15,000 American and Vietnamese troops at the airport, who were well drug in and well protected. A few hundred. You can't be serious in that kind of an attack. But that was not the point. The point was the cumulative impact. Americans turned on the 7 o'clock news that night, and they were shocked. Said one TV oaf, how, after all these years of favorable kill ratios and glowing progress reports, could a bunch of kids in sneakers be running through the American embassy? Of course, they were not just running, they were running to their own deaths, but this visual presence is so devastating here on the home front. Well, I suppose it was devastating. It was hard for us to see how it could be so devastating, but, I mean, this was the way the war had been, we'd witnessed for years. So. Also, they didn't run through the American embassy. Well, the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong failed to hold any province capital. In some instances, they only lingered long enough to run up a flag, then take it down after the American television cameras had finished. They paid a terrible price in terms of casualties. Not by accident, the Southern Viet Cong say, we bore the brunt. 40,000 guerrillas killed. A generation of jungle fighters wiped out. Yet it was a tremendous victory over the United States. That pretty much is history's judgment now. It was a military defeat and a political victory for the other side. Jacques, as I said, has spelled this all out in his book, and the purpose, the design of this campaign was to win the war by destroying South Vietnam's military and political institutions. It failed and thus became a great ironic moment in the Vietnam War. A military disaster, 70,000 of Jop's finest troops died in the streets of southern cities, along with the cream of the southern cadres, and no visible military accomplishment. Lin Piao, the great Chinese military doctrinaire, author of the book Long Live the People's War, which was published, actually, coincidentally, in mid-64. Lin Piao, I'm sure, looking on this Tet Offensive, would have paraphrased the French general who stood at on the heights watching the charge of the Light Brigade. You know about the Light Brigade? Tennyson's poem, cannons to the left of them, cannons to the right of them. Theirs was not a reason why, theirs was but to do or die. Into the valley of death charged the 600. And the French general standing on the hill, watching this, saying, it is magnificent, but it is not war. And I can imagine Lin Piao saying, we lost 70,000 men in the streets of southern cities. That's magnificent, but it's not people's war. But it produced an impressive victory in the name of political struggle, brought down the President of the United States, Lyndon Johnson deciding not to run for re-election. Jop had masterminded this campaign out of faith in armed struggle. He experienced bitter defeat, but ironically, he was proving what his doctrinal opponents in the Politburo were insisting all along, that victory cannot be won in a military slugging match. It can be won only through proper political struggle tactics. And almost here, Trung saying, congratulations, you did it very well. You brought down the President of the United States. Boy, that's really something. Well, then came the next segment, this what we sometimes call the fight-talk period. Have any questions on the Tet Offensive, or anything that isn't clear? Yeah.
I have a question about the campaign. One of the objectives was to get rid of the weakening.
Yeah, well, that's one of the many rumors. Well, it was, if you believe this, and I'm not sure I do, I've tried to check it out in Hanoi, and I get denials, of course, but the southern Viet Cong simply believed that the northerners were afraid of them as a political force, and because of what happened previously after the Viet Minh War. So they wanted to expend them if they could without. It is true that the Pavan in the south sat out the whole Tet Offensive with some operations in Hue, but the rest of the war of that battle, that whole offensive, was the middle phase, was fought by the southerners. And we heard this rumor in Saigon right at the start of the Tet Offensive that the prisoners were getting very bitter about the fact that the South Viet Cong, that they'd been sent on this, like this kid who, you know, later I wonder what were they thinking in telling me to do this. Anyway, the rumor spread very widely, and along with it, the rumor, Vietnam, of course, was full of rumors from Radio Catanau, it was called, the rumor mill, the beginning and end of it still goes on. But a parallel to this rumor was the rumor that, you notice, they're not hitting American installations particularly. They're hitting BC or a Vietnamese installation. That's a deal that the North Vietnamese and the Americans have made to get rid of the Viet Cong. And this was very widespread, and everybody, you heard it on all sides. And the ambassador called me in and said, have you heard this rumor about us and General Jop have a deal to get rid of the... Yeah, I've heard it. He said, I think we've got to deny it. I want to go on Vietnamese radio and deny this, that it's true. And there's the worst thing you can do. It just gives currency to it. And it just gives people, Vietnamese who hear this, say, ah, maybe there is something to it. Here the ambassador is denying it. But I couldn't talk him out of it, and he went on the radio, and my Vietnamese friends came in and said, is it true? Are you Americans really in league with him? It's part of the conspiracy thesis. Yes, could make a movie of this. Oliver Stone could probably make. Anyway, we weren't, just for the record, we were not in conspiring with General Jopp. But I don't know why, you know, I don't really think it was that callous, that cruel, that totally heartless. But I don't know, you know, those guys are very, that thing I just read, what difference does it make how many die? Any other questions? All right, next came what we informally call the fight talk period. Fight, talk, talk period. July 68. Well, you know, let me say the end of the phase three. I have to say the problem with this three-month stage was it has to, both the phase one and the phase two have to go a certain direction, certain success, in order to set the stage for phase three, which was April, May, June of 1968. And what was supposed to come, according to the book and a lot of intelligence, was what was called the second wave. That was a code word for something very big that was going to happen in the last 3 months of this campaign. The model for it apparently was Dien Bien Phu, which broke the capper that broke the back of the French. So one of these, there was some specific target, and probably only a few people in Hanoi knew what they were, and none of the people in the south, they were told it's different names, get ready for different attacks, and we'll tell you which one it is at the last minute. Khe Sanh was a very major candidate here. The city of Hue was also considered to be could be a capper, a psychological backbreaker, or Saigon itself. But second wave never came because events in the first two phases didn't build, as they say in the theater. So it just didn't. So it was abandoned, and we never knew what the second wave was. I'm inclined to think it was probably Hue, but it could have been Khantoum even, which wasn't all that big. It was just something that would just utterly shock the Americans, the second shock, as Dien Bien Phu did, shock the French, and we would throw in the towel. Well, there was a very large fighting, a great deal of fighting, what they called high points, in those last 3 months, but it wasn't following the scenario at all. And so as far as General Jopp was concerned, he was down, but he wasn't out. And so he retired to his sand tables and started to devise a new amended strategy. One that would nullify the enemy's advantages, which would become apparent in the winter-spring offensive. At the same time, his cohort, the party secretary, Lê Duẩn, began a series of moves on the diplomatic, political, communicational, psychological front. After a considerable amount of doctrinal stumbling around, a new strategy emerged in Hanoi in mid-1969. Ever faithful to armed struggle, political struggle, Dao Chan, the pincer notion, it adapted the old and added two new concepts. First, in seeking to form a new form of armed struggle, it made a division between Havan, the northern troops, and the PLAF, what was left of them in the south. Most of the PLF was then reinforced by northerners into Viet Cong units. They're called filler packets. They sent down small individuals and they went into the organizational structure of the PLAF. And they began to experiment with a new kind of unit called the Special Action Squad. Or we usually call them the sapper teams, special sapper team. They use the term sapper too. Sapper is, in U.S. military terminology, means a military engineer who's usually good on explosives and blows up things, also constructs things. But the meaning in the North Vietnamese was broader than this. In a sense, it was a new kind of guerrilla force, new kind of guerrilla individual, one who was highly trained, technologically skilled, and used the best weapons, demolition devices, and communication instruments that the communist world's research and development laboratories could produce. Press called them the super guerrillas. That's not entirely a wrong phrase. A strategy called for fielding these units which would simultaneously hit, strike hard, and surgically take out important but not big major enemy installations, then vanish into the night. The image conjured up was a professional football team that hit and bounced back and got out. They would hit the government installations, anything that was not too well defended. Blow up whatever they could and get out, and inflict as many casualties as possible, but get out without any casualties on their part at all. It was very impressive. And this is almost entirely against Arvin, against some Americans. But the idea was you'd continue this strategy until the South was bled to death. Now this bypassed the enemy's advantage in mass and movement. As I say, there were still Pavan troops were conducting battles and raids and so on, military high points, as they were called, mostly against Arvin. But the techniques, the strategy against these super guerrillas was simply that you had to be a super counter-guerrilla yourself. And there are a lot of techniques that you can develop in using sensors and so on. So as the several years rolled on, this didn't work quite as well. And the super guerrillas were taking casualties. And this was particularly serious because they were very well trained, very hard. You know, this is your quarterback, and if you keep losing quarterbacks, the quality of the team's performance is going to go down. You just can't supply new ones that fast. But for a time, it was an extremely impressive performance. It also, of course, all of this pushed the Pavan troops as well as these PLAF, the filler packets in the PLAF units, into a more prominent and mainline role in the war. By the early 1970s, about 90% of the day-to-day combat in the South was being done by uniformed Pavan regulars from the North. In uniform, their fiberboard helmets, 90%, as opposed to 5 or 6 years ago, it had been about 10%. And a few years before that, it had been hardly any. Well, this Northern involvement continued to increase, and finally, until the 1972 Easter Offensive, every North Vietnamese, every Pavan division, infantry division, except one, was outside of Hanoi, outside of North Vietnam. One of them was guarding the capital. All the rest were out. I think there were 21 of them. The second new concept was that political that was devised after the Tet Offensive, the Winter Spring Campaign, was political struggle was extended externally, and innovative efforts to influence foreign and especially U.S. behavior. In part, this involved various psychological gestures concerning negotiations, political settlement of the war, hence the talk dimension of this fight, fight, talk, talk label, which is given to the period. Paris meetings on Vietnam began in early 68. North Vietnamese decision to negotiate with the enemy, something they had steadfastly refused to do previously, was a reflection basically of the situation and the division within the Politburo. It was a concession to Foreign Minister Nguyen Duy Trinh, to Lê Đức Thọ, and to Trung Chinh, and others in the Politburo who had argued for nearly a decade that non-military strategy for to achieve unification was possible, would work, and what it needed was a very special kind of political Dao Chan. It involved negotiations on the international diplomatic level, extremely broad-based political coalition arrangements and offers in South Vietnam. Others in the Politburo saw utility in the Paris talks, even though they did not expect unification would come out of it. Despite differences, the Politburo seemed to believe there was much advantage to be gained because of its estimate from late 1968 that U.S. domestic opposition to the war was so great it was just a matter of a few months before the U.S. would force itself out of Vietnam. Much more on this and the whole role of the anti-war movement in lectures 22 and 23. The Americans countered with what came to be called Vietnamization, the effort to disengage without triggering the disintegration of the South Vietnamese government. That, in fact, became the context of the external political struggle. The American attempt to create a viable South Vietnam that could stand alone, but with American financial and logistic assistance, versus the communist attempt to ruin the effort and to force or maneuver the U.S. into handing over South Vietnam. This political struggle involved establishing an enclave for the newly formed provisional